Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Sponsored once again today by Simply Safe Home Security. Visit simplysafe.com/ricochet. Jim, all good martinis today. Good, good, and good. We've had kind of an odd conglomeration in a few days already this week, so we figure our listeners deserve a break and a few reasons to cheer, although they might not necessarily cheer for all of them, depending on their particular conservative bent. But let's start with the big news of the day, and that's that the Democrats have essentially forced the erosion of their own power as a minority party in the United States Senate. They have just voted, as we recorded this, to not invoke cloture on the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to be the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. As a result, we are now going to start entering a whole series of procedural votes, which will have largely taken place, I'm sure, by the time most folks hear this. Very, very helpful little handy guide here from Mitch McConnell's office with bullet points on how this is going to play out today. 11 o'clock, cloture vote on the Gorsuch nomination. If that vote fails, there will be at least one procedural vote, including the vote on the motion to reconsider. You know the big vote is coming when the leader makes a point of order and there is an appeal of the ruling of the chair. After that motion, it's possible that more procedural votes will take place. Then in bold and italics, then there will be a vote on appealing the ruling of the chair. Following that vote, there will be a second cloture vote. And after the second cloture vote, there will be up to 30 hours of post-cloture debate and a final vote on Friday. So a lot of procedural mumbo-jumbo, but it's important mumbo-jumbo today, Jim, because the Senate rules are changing. The Democrats forced their hands on a nominee they really can't find any substantive objection on. So they've decided to basically nuke their opportunity to stop anybody more divisive, more objectionable if there's another Supreme Court vacancy here. And just to make matters more fun, Jim, of course, the Democrats and the mainstream media are talking about how this rule change is an assault on democracy and blah, 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 and the institutions of the Senate that go back decades. Very interesting how they didn't see it that way just 4 years ago, really less than 4 years ago, when Harry Reid decided to nuke the filibuster for lower court judges and presidential appointments to other positions inside the government. Here's just a quick smattering. Hat tip to Newsbusters for putting this together. Here was Ron Brownstein on CNN back then.
Well, the idea of requiring a supermajority for the president to appoint his nominees just is anachronistic.
Al Sharpton.
This afternoon, Democrats took the bold step of changing Senate rules, scaling back the filibuster that Republicans have unfairly used to block the president's nominees.
Chris Matthews.
It's due to the action of the Senate Democrats today, there will be no more 60-vote requirements to get the president's appointments confirmed, no more dallying around and delay tactics, no more Mickey Mouse. And with any luck, there will be action.
And Chris Hayes.
I agree with you about this being an affirmative win for democracy. If that is the case, why do we still have the filibuster for legislation?
Ah, he wanted to nuke it altogether. That'll come back. But
good question, Chris Hayes.
But the most prescient observation that day comes from a guy I give a hard time to once in a while. That would be Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. After the rule change went in, he said this to the Democrats.
Say to my friends on the other side of the aisle, you'll regret this, and you may regret it a lot sooner than you think.
Yeah, less than 4 years later. So, Jim, the Democrats kind of hoisted themselves on their own petard here, and Republicans are not about to be bullied by people with no real power.
He hasn't said it today, but it's somewhat, I tried to warn you. I told you I'd do this, and nobody wanted to listen to me, but here we are. So all of you can eat it now. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is a classy individual and would never resort to language like that. But it's fun to imagine that. Look, you know, a lot of the this at the core of this is kind of something that we've struggled with in our democracy since the very beginning. Right. How, you know, should the majority rule? Yeah, kind of generally, sort of. Except you kind of don't want the rights of the minority to be completely crushed and washed away. So how do you balance that? Well, you know, for a lot of things for a long time, it was, well, you need a majority of votes. And then we realized, well, we want to give the minority a certain amount of ability to influence things. So we're going to create this 60% or this 60 vote rule in order to cut off debate and can move forward with the business at hand. That was, you know, obscure for a very while, grew more and more common. People's perspective on the filibuster is almost always perfectly aligned with whether or not their preferred power party is in power.
Yes.
And everybody completely reverses themselves every time control of the Senate switches back and forth. We have an enormous amount of fun laughing at these people when they completely forget what they said 3 years ago. Look, Senate Democrats, you're not going to get a Supreme Court justice from President Trump that you're going to like. Let's just get that out of the way. It's just not going to happen, and it's unreasonable to expect that this seat is going to remain vacant for the next 4 years. You can try. You go to the American people. You remember, as of November, you were saying it was ridiculous and an outrage and terrible for there to be one vacant seat. Now say, yeah, we're going to try to filibuster every nominee from President Trump for the next couple of years. So conceivably, if another justice keels over or retires, we'll have even more openings on the Supreme Court. You can try to make that argument. I don't think that strikes me as a particularly reasonable way of going about this. I think if you're the Senate Democrats, you should be looking for the least worst judge that you could or nominee that you could possibly get from President Trump. And I think Neil Gorsuch, by being very qualified, by being very even-tempered, and also by indicating he's willing to be critical of President Trump when he believes that he's violating the Constitution. Senate Democrats, Neil Gorsuch is about as good as it gets. He's about as good as it gets from our perspective and about as good as it's going to get from your perspective. The next one, according to rumor, according to himself, Andrew Napolitano says he's next in line. So if you'd prefer to not have Gorsuch and you'd rather have Justice Napolitano, hey, we can do that. You want to see Trump's sister on the court? We can go that course too.
I don't know if we're going to do that.
Yeah, actually, they might like that one. You know? But the gist being, this is where this is about as good as. And if you want to take this stance, fine. But this means you have no control over. You're not going to stop Gorsuch from getting up in the Supreme Court. Two, it means you have no power over this until the earliest possible chances after the midterms in 2018. You look at that map. You look at the Senate Democrats who are up. You look at the number of Republicans that are up. The chances of the Democrats taking the Senate don't look great right now. I'm sure there were some Republicans who were saying the same thing in April 2005. things can change. It's only a two-seat majority for Republicans, but Democrats just have a lot of seats to protect, and it's just not going to doesn't look good for them. So all in all, there's a good chance they don't have control of the Senate until 2020. If you guys are comfortable with that, fine, go ahead with this. But otherwise, I would have ditched the filibuster. And then at the very least, you have an option in case Trump makes a genuinely, indisputably bad pick seen by both sides across the aisle on the next one. Maybe you have a chance of blocking that one. As it is, they will lose all ability to block nominees for at least till 2018 and conceivably for the rest of Trump's presidency, or maybe even beyond 2020. Let's see how, we don't know when Democrats are going to control the Senate again.
Let's move on to the second good martini. And Jim, it's so nice to see people in foreign policy positions that don't grovel and just waffle like John Kerry. And then we had Susan Rice and Samantha Power at the UN for the 8 years of Obama. Nikki Haley is there now. I think a few people were probably surprised that Nikki Haley was the choice for this job. They think of her as governor of South Carolina, maybe not a ton of experience on the international stage. But so far, as we've talked about earlier in the week, she seems to be the one who's the main spokesperson for this administration when it comes to foreign crises. And the issue on Wednesday was Syria before the UN Security Council. And Nikki Haley was responding to the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons on civilians, and she was firing at Russia with both barrels. This is an extended clip here that goes after Assad, the Iranians, the Russians, and I wish you could see the video here. And if you haven't seen it, you should, because it ends with a great stare. Here's Nikki Haley.
The truth is that Assad, Russia, and Iran have no interest in peace. The illegitimate Syrian government, led by a man with no conscience, has committed untold atrocities against his people for more than 6 years. Assad has made it clear that he doesn't want to take part in a meaningful political process. Iran has reinforced Assad's military, and Russia has shielded Assad from UN sanctions. If Russia has the influence in Syria that it claims to have, we need to see them use it. We need to see them put an end to these horrific acts. How many more children have to die before Russia cares?
And then she just stared at the Russian ambassador for 3 seconds, Jim. That stare might soon rival the tears of General Mattis at the Pentagon for most effective lobbying, especially if the Russians actually budge here. When it comes to her further comments, she talked about how the UN was essentially powerless to even enforce its bans on the use of chemical weapons and so forth. So who knows what will actually happen here? We still don't know what exactly Trump's going to do about this, but it's about time somebody really called Russia on the carpet for meddling there and then not taking any responsibility.
You know, when I saw Nikki Haley making that statement, I was thinking about another high profile, high stakes confrontation with the Russians at the UN came during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And people, you know, this is a chapter of history that people kind of feel like they know. They may have seen the X-Men movie that alluded to it, but they didn't really pay attention. You know, it's one of the rare moments in time where a presentation at the United Nations was really, really important and may have actually made a big difference on whether or not the entire world went to had a nuclear conflict. Adlai Stevenson, who was not known as a particularly tough, hawkish persona, was presenting the evidence for the presence of Soviet missiles in Cuba. And at some point, he gets a denial from the Soviet ambassador to the United Nations. And then he unveils all the photo evidence they have. And he unveils it, and you can see the maps, and you can see the pictures, and you can see the missiles on trucks and stuff like that. And Adlai Stevenson, just, you know, you can just tell he's totally nailed him. And the Soviet ambassador is just sitting there kind of staring with this deer in the headlights look. And Adlai Stevenson says, don't wait for the translation. Just answer the question. Yes or no. Do you have, you know, and he really nails it to the guy. And one of the great ironies is that I believe President Kennedy had been saying to Stevenson, you really got to take it to them. We really need you to nail them to the wall on this so that the entire world realizes we're not the ones who are escalating this conflict. They're the ones who've taken this critical moment. I kept waiting for Nikki. For those of us, for the really the true geeks in this will recognize, this is the line of dialogue was echoed in, I believe it was Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, but the Klingons using that. But very, you know, clearly kind of a echo of that historical moment in which, look, we all know Russia likes Assad's regime. They're helping him out. They're backing them out. They have a port in Tartus, which is very important for Russia projecting power. Russia is back in business in the Middle East. They kind of stepped into this role during the Obama administration, and it's probably bad for our interests. Well, this also means that Russia pretty much at the best case scenario turns a blind eye when Assad uses chemical weapons. Or maybe they're even encouraging it. Certainly they have no objection to this. And what's more, the actions they take at the United Nations stop international reaction to these sorts of things. And there used to be a broad across-the-board global prohibition and taboo on the use of chemical weapons. People learned the lessons of World War I. People remembered things like the gassing of the Kurds, and they realized that when somebody else does this, you know, as Obama said at one point, there's a red line. This has got to have huge consequence, or else we're going to face a future in which poison gas or biological weapons or things like that are used with impunity, are used with no real consequence. Earlier this week, I had written, it's easy to forget, Greg, back in the Persian Gulf War, you know, when there was concern that Saddam Hussein might use chemical weapons against us or use chemical weapons against Israel and Scud missiles and stuff like that, the statements from Dick Cheney and several other U.S. policymakers were sent through very clear channels to Hussein and the Iraqi regime. Look, if you guys use chemical weapons or biological weapons, we have our own non-conventional weapons that we're willing to use in response. By that, the United States meant nuclear weapons. We were willing to say, if you use poison gas on our guys, we will nuke you, right? That's how strongly we felt about this. Now, whether or not this is the right course of action or something to, you know, whether we need to do that in this particular case, I don't know. We can debate this. But at the very least, we need to call out Russia. And that's what Nikki Haley is doing very effectively here and doing in a very dramatic, high-profile way. Which I can't help but notice, Greg, is not something Rex Tillerson seems to have any interest in doing, at least so far in his term as Secretary of State. So, you know, as we kind of alluded earlier in the week, maybe Nikki Haley is the de facto Secretary of State when it comes to the being America's face to the world.
Which stare would you think was more intimidating, Tillerson or Haley? I'm going with Haley on that one.
Ah! Oh, yeah. You can tell she's already thinking about what she's going to do to you.
Oh, fascinating backstory there about all the surveillance and Adlai Stevenson at the UN. I was starting to wonder, Jim, if all that sort of surveillance was the the original prototype for SimpliSafe, and they just needed the internet and the other things to catch up technology-wise to put the whole system together. We've talked about SimpliSafe a lot of different times on this program. We've given stories about why this system would be so beneficial to you and why it's a good deal. But now we're also talking about all of the different features that SimpliSafe provides. And because when you order your SimpliSafe home security system online, you're really taking the first easy step to protecting your home and your family with entry sensors, motion sensors, glass break sensors. Soon you'll be making your home a burglar's worst nightmare. And you'll be done in under an hour.
SimpliSafe comes pre-programmed to work right out of the box. Just plug in the base station and it will talk you through the whole process. Seriously, even someone who isn't the slightest bit handy can install it. The entire system is wireless, so there's no need to drill holes in your walls or do any other permanent damage. And once you're all set up, SimpliSafe makes it just as easy to stay protected month to month. There are no long-term contracts, no hidden fees. And it's just $14.99 a month for 24 hours a day service, 7 days a week, professional monitoring and emergency dispatch.
Don't wait another day to take your home safety into your own hands. Why would you want to? Just get SimpliSafe. Go to simplisafe.com/ricochet right now to get 10% off your home security system. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com. Go now, simplisafe.com/ricochet. All right, on to our third good martini now, Jim. And this one might be slightly controversial, depending on where our listeners are coming from on this, but certainly one of the more polarizing members of the Trump campaign in the last couple months, and certainly in the early stages of his administration, has been Steve Bannon, the former chairman of Breitbart. He has certainly rubbed traditional conservatives the wrong way on a number of occasions. He made some headlines that we talked about towards the end of the failed health care bill effort, where he just went up to Capitol Hill and told conservatives they had to vote for that, and that was the end of the story. Turns out they didn't have to vote for it. Now he has lost a little bit of his clout inside the administration. New York Times, in a move that was widely seen as a sign of changing fortunes, Mr. Trump removed Mr. Bannon, his chief strategist, from the National Security Council's cabinet-level principals committee on Wednesday. The shift was orchestrated by Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, Mr. Trump's national security advisor, who insisted on purging a political advisor from the Situation Room, where decisions about war and peace are made. Mr. Bannon resisted the move, even threatening at one point to quit if it went forward, according to a White House official who, like others, insisted on anonymity to discuss internal deliberations. Mr. Bannon's camp denied that he had threatened to resign and spent the day spreading the word that the shift was a natural evolution, not a signal of any diminution of his outsized influence. I know there was one rumor yesterday, Jim, that he was only on there to keep an eye on Mike Flynn, and now that Flynn was gone, they just didn't need him there anymore. So Rick Perry apparently got the slot, which led to a lot of gifs of him marching around the Dancing with the Stars floor yesterday on Twitter. So the people who like Steve Bannon, the people who don't like Steve Bannon but think he was a conservative influence, the people who just don't like him at all, reacting to this, how significant is this?
It is pretty significant. I think what was most intriguing are the reports in places like Politico, once again, citing unnamed White House sources, so you can decide how much faith you want to put into this, but apparently Bannon did not take this well and threatened to quit the White House entirely. His critics would probably say, don't let the door hit you on the way out. But that would have been, I think, the sort of thing that would have had, you know, a real earthquake to this administration, because Bannon is seen as a very big influence on Trump and someone who has pushed him certainly in the hands and had a big say in the travel ban and the various immigration positions and things like that. Look, I've had people who are plugged into the White House describe it to me, a situation which doesn't, you know, the team of rivals approach. Now, I got to say, this doesn't sound like the ideal system from where I'm sitting, but you have Trump, obviously Vice President Mike Pence has a great deal of influence over Trump's thinking and decision makings and things like that, a very trusted advisor. Reince Priebus is the formal chief of staff, and obviously the chief of staff is traditionally one of the most powerful positions in any White House. But then you had Bannon as chief counsel, and Bannon undoubtedly is somebody, some people have described him as Trump's id, that the somebody who's very much plugged in and very much can have great influence on him. I heard somebody describing that he's the last one to leave in the night, and he's the first one to arrive in the morning because he always wants to be the first person to talk to Trump and the last person to Trump talk to Trump, because those are the people who have the most influence in Trump's decision making. But wait, there's more. There's Kellyanne Conway, who obviously has a very great deal of influence, was sometimes called the Trump whisperer, the one who could calm him down or get him to see perspectives that he previously would not have even considered. You obviously have Ivanka Trump, perhaps the most influencing, biggest influence of all. Obviously, every man is going to listen to his daughter. And of course, there's Jared Kushner. Jared is considered to, you know, wearing more and more hats in this administration. So you've got six or seven major figures who all have a, and then you probably could throw in Gary Cohn on the economic issues. So maybe we're up to seven really big name figures or very influential people who are all very much concerned about who has the most influence, who has the president's ear, who is he listening to, who's traveling with the president, who's with him today, who's he meeting. And it just sounds like Game of Thrones, Greg. And there's this constant backstabbing and leaking and competition and sharp elbows. And you know, people who read National Review saw my piece yesterday about how a lack of, you know, appointments to the Federal Energy Regulation Commission is holding up these big pipeline projects that presumably the administration would love to see happen, because these are places like Michigan and Ohio where here's some nice $50 an hour blue collar jobs for people, union jobs. In fact, come on, we can, you know, here's a big construction project. This is exactly what he talked about, but we can't do it until FERC gets the nominees. And the Trump administration still hasn't formally nominated the figures. Guys, could somebody pay attention to this kind of stuff? Could you spend a little less time trying to stab each other in the back and focus on who's, you know, who's highest in the pecking order and stuff like that? Everybody cites the Abraham Lincoln example of team of rivals in the cabinet. Well, maybe it worked because it was Abraham Lincoln. And maybe when you don't have – when you have team of rivals without Abraham Lincoln, you end up with a team of just – team of people fighting with each other and not getting stuff done or something like that. So – there's a really fair questions to be asked about whether Steve Bannon ever really belonged in the National Security Council. He certainly didn't have the kind of background one would expect to have in an institution like that. Look, maybe a smaller workload, he'll be able to refocus and do better work there. But I think people are going to see endless tales of palace intrigue by this. And I think that part of the problem stems from a president who's look, he's a little bit of a blank slate. He's a little bit of a guy who says contradictory things, doesn't have a long history in politics, and not well-established, etched-in-stone principles. And I think this is making governing a great deal more complicated, and hopefully it gets simpler and things can turn around. But I, you know, lately I've been talking to a lot of Republicans who are getting really nervous about this this management structure at within the White House.
Three good martinis, depending on your take on each of those.
That last one got sad, but no, trust me. All in all, it's probably better to have Bannon off the NSC.
Jim, rest up. Enjoy the nuclear meltdown in Washington today, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and don't forget to visit our friends at Simply Safe Home Security, simplysafe.com/ricochet, and tune in Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.